Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. If you ask yourself, what are the odds? Denise Chisholm can probably tell you, insofar as market outcomes are concerned. A sector strategist at Fidelity Investments, Denise leverages historical data as part of a probability framework that helps her evaluate risk and opportunity in the equity market. Our conversation explores episodes when her process uncovered overlooked relationships that were hiding in plain sight. During the GFC, for instance, Denise connected faltering housing prices with default implications on Countrywide's mortgage portfolio. Her work on probability is sometimes multi-layered. For instance, in evaluating the reaction of the long end of the yield curve to Fed tightening cycles, Denise found that conditional on the leading economic indicator index falling, the 10-year yield increased only 30% of the time when policy was tightened. More currently, we discuss what Denise sees in markets today. Here, she observes a strong recovery in wages from the COVID bottom as correlated to outperformance of cyclicals over defensives. Lastly, she shares a strong view on the energy sector, linked to a combination of low capital spending and high free cash flow. As we round out our discussion, I solicit Denise's views on the state of progress for women in the field of finance. And here, unsurprisingly, she's focused on the numbers, viewing plenty of upside in the 20% of women that comprise senior leadership roles in financial services. Progress here can result from showing women at a young age just how interesting and rewarding a career in finance can be. I hope you enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Denise Chisholm. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Denise Chisholm. She is a sector strategist within equity research at Fidelity Investments. Denise, thanks for making yourself available and being a guest on our podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me, Dean.
Well, we've recently met, and I've certainly gotten very interested in a lot of your framework just around probability assessments and really thinking about what different relationships tell us about the odds of various outcomes. So we'll have plenty to talk through just in terms of your framework for assessing market risk and return. As we get our conversation started, tell us about a little bit about you, how you came to be a part of the finance industry. What got you started in the world of finance?
I have a pretty atypical background. Although that said, I feel like I meet more and more people in investment research that have atypical backgrounds. Originally, I majored in economics and I went to law school briefly before I realized very quickly that data-based research, like in economics, was way more interesting to me than law school. So in some ways, I always tell my kids, you know, you learn more from losing than winning. And it was sort of out of that, to a lesser extent, failure of going to law school and realizing it wasn't for me that really made me think about what kind of research I like to do, why I like to do it. And I landed in a bunch of different, what I'll call data-based jobs. First for the US government, actually, I was a cost analyst for the Department of Defense, and then for a small cost of living firm. And I landed somewhat backwards at the job at Fidelity, where they were really looking for people to support their fundamental analysts with more statistical research, which was a little bit my background within economics, was statistics. And what was interesting is, if you remember at the time, I mean, I think people still do this, but, oh, you know, stocks follow earnings. They show two lines that go together. Everybody in the room goes, these two lines don't go together. And you sort of turn the page. Well, they really wanted people to do a deep dive on what the critical variables really were. So that's really where I started at Fidelity. And what was very clear is that I had absolutely no background in finance whatsoever. I mean, economics is not nearly the same thing as investments. And I didn't know a thing. I didn't know what PE meant. I didn't know anything. And the good news about not knowing anything is that you really can't hide it. So the other silver lining to that is you want to ramp as fast as possible. And Fidelity is a great place to do that because they did not have a problem that I had no background in the financial industry. And they said, we can teach you all that. And it was a great way to learn. In some ways, given my role at the time, most people, when interns came in, and interns are sort of the hardest working people at Fidelity, I like to say, because they really want the job and they've got 3 months, there's about 8 of them, and they've got 3 months to do a presentation that's really a deep dive on their industry. Well, nobody from a support perspective wants to touch them with a 10-foot pole because there's so much work, but they teach you so much. So I really dug in my heels in that role, which was called a sector specialist at the time. Actually, I think it's still called that. I really took all the interns. I said, all the interns, I'm happy to take everybody who comes in the door and learn as fast as possible. And I think that really set the stage for understanding what is very complicated and differences between the sectors and industries pretty quickly.
There's been some talk recently about, for example, the value of a CFA charter and the material that is taught from a textbook standpoint, trying to be relevant to the world of being a securities analyst. But I can imagine the textbook versus the practice can be vastly different. Even the practice evolves so much over time. And I was curious, just in terms of your start in the industry relative to now, the discipline of analyzing market prices or the value of securities, what's been the evolution of that? And just in terms of the focus on things like price to earnings ratios, the movement to a more factorized approach to trying to assess value, what are some of the big picture changes that you've observed over time in your position?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a CFA. And in some ways, it's because I didn't follow, as much as I have an atypical background, I also didn't follow a typical career path. I never became a fundamental analyst. I never talked to companies and built company models and looked at it that way. And in fact, I never even really did a lot of financial theory that you're talking about, the evolution of financial theory. In some ways, what was important in the 90s was ROIC, how that evolved to maybe its earnings growth or maybe different trajectories and how we should think about those factors and how they should be valued in the market, free cash flow, all of that, like that evolution. I never really spent a lot of time on the theory. I always looked at the historical data and how it evolved. And I was always actually struck by the fact that very few people look at it that way. We spend a lot of time on theory and the mathematics behind it, but never look at the real world examples. And I think that that's important to do, not because the theory doesn't matter, but because it does something in economics we always used to call holds all else equal. The problem is nothing is ever equal over time. So I think that looking back in history can help you understand not whether or not this is a driver to watch, but is it the driver to watch? Could it more than likely be offset by other factors that you're not considering in your theoretical framework? And that's sort of how I've approached the market. So less theoretical, less financial, and more market history and probabilities.
I think that's really interesting. And what I've been saying recently is, even if you gave me, for example, the CPI report, if you gave me non-farm payrolls in advance, boy, I still think it's difficult to know what the market's going to do in reaction to some of these data points. But putting it into a probabilistic framework certainly can serve as valuable guidance. And I think we'll spend a lot of time talking about that because you've got some really interesting matrices that you've created and so forth. As you look back on periods of whether they're market dislocation or times where there was some sea change that might have been occurring in markets, are there instances you can recall where your probabilistic framework was pointing to something that was reasonably out of consensus, whether it was the market to the upside, to the downside, perhaps one sector versus another? What are some of the instances in which that framework disagreed, let's say, with the narrative at hand in markets?
So I started in the late 90s, and it's hard to think about important things that happened in the financial markets without talking about the financial crisis in 2009. So that was certainly formidable. And it taught me a really interesting perspective on data. Because at the time, Countrywide released a lot of information on their book for home price appreciation. And it was very, very closely correlated, and statistically so, to mortgage delinquencies. So if you looked at that and just did a really simple linear regression on what Countrywide was saying the HPAs were, which were rapidly declining and then going negative, versus delinquencies, you ended up popping it into a model. Again, a freshman economics student could do this very easily. There was nothing interesting about it, and getting an answer of like 4.5%, which was about double what the highest, this is MBA at the time, what the highest delinquency rate was that we had ever saw. And I remember presenting it to a portfolio manager. And I said, well, my point is not that it's going to be 4.5%. My point is that delinquencies could be rising. And he said, why couldn't it be 4.5%? And ultimately, it turned out to be much higher than that. And I think it taught me two interesting things about data. One is that's somewhat obvious in hindsight, which is never discount the odds of any kind of outsized event if it's based on data. But for me, the second important takeaway was to be really open-minded when it comes to statistics. I think that unique events, and I'm not just talking about the financial crisis, don't really come with a normalized distribution, right? Some small sample sizes can be the exact right way to look at the data if those are the really meaningful data points that we should be looking at. And I think you can sort of fast forward to today, and I think that there were a unique set of circumstances around the pandemic that actually said much the same things that you could apply, even though the pandemic was different. Every recession is different from each other. They all have different underlying components. Yet you can see the same patterns through stocks, through valuation spreads, which is a key indicator that I look at, and then through government stimulus. And you can notice if you do a deep historical dive that valuation spreads are a measure of fear in the market. The names change, but basically the spread always stays the same. When investors sell anything they think is risky and they buy anything they think is safe and they bid that up and they create a spread, and that creates the probability of a market finding a bottom. And if you look back historically, even though these things are not at all similar, what you can find is a very monotonic relationship to the number of months the market discounts a recession in advance. And that was why it was so important that government stimulus was coincident with the crisis. That was a meaningful statistical event that occurred as valuation spreads were 75% of the way through pandemic levels. So I think that even though the pandemic was so, so different, you could really look back in history, and again, sort of taking the lesson from the financial crisis, small sample size, you don't have many recessions to choose from. The quants would tell you it's not particularly statistically significant, but if that's the right data, I think it sends a very clear message of what the next move in the market could be.
As you talk about the financial crisis, it got me thinking about your usage of data, and perhaps, and this is where I'd love for you to share some of your thoughts on this, perhaps it's your process is going to take you where you need to be. And perhaps looking at HPAs in 2008 was not a thing for you back in 2000, but it became something that was so central to the market risk dynamic that deriving relationships between housing price appreciation and delinquencies became a thing. Perhaps in the pandemic, it was looking at restaurant traffic with more availability of data and trying to see what the reopening looked like. Tell us a little bit about that in terms of your process. Is it something that allows you to go anywhere in terms of where the action is? Give us a little bit more insight in terms of your usage of data sets.
No, that's a great point. And it's not a model at all, right? It's not that you put in house price appreciation and you put in valuation and you put in valuation spreads and it tells you what sectors are going to lead and what the equity market's going to do over the next 12 months. Equity markets, and maybe any markets, are much, much more complicated than that. So you do have to evolve, and you have to evolve to the data that matters. And in some ways, if you can either short or flex your time horizon to look at the change in correlations, whether they be increasing or decreasing, and those change in probabilities, whether they be increasing or decreasing, to highlight to you what matters when. And I think it's important to understand that my process isn't a model, but it's more of like a wealth of evidence approach. It's not based on just what industrial production is doing. It's based on what industrial production is doing, what inflation expectations are doing, plus where we are in the cycle, plus the valuation of financials. So all of those things are unique, but each one carries its own probabilities that point to an investment conclusion or decision or positive risk reward. And it's overlaying those into a more wealth of evidence approach, or a weight of the evidence approach, that's the way I approach the market. So history doesn't repeat, obviously, but I think that the data can tell you what's different, and whether or not it's meaningful. I'll give you like two case in points. One is interest rates in the Fed. I mean, it was interesting. When did they start raising last cycle? Was it 2014? I think it was 2014. And there was a strong concern in the market that interest rates were going to rise. Certainly long interest rates were going to rise. This is going to be a problem for the housing market. This is going to be a problem for the consumer. And what's really interesting when you look in the data, that the long bond, long treasury yields, 10-year yields, only have 30% odds of actually going higher when the Fed is hiking if global LEIs are decelerating, which is the exact situation we were in. So again, that only happens a third of the time. So it's not the bulk of occurrences, but it's the importance of that occurrence that I think is really important to understand and led to an investment conclusion. So it's layering those odds. And the second one that I already talked about was valuation spreads. And what's really different this cycle versus any other cycle is that they're persistently wide. Most recoveries, what you end up seeing is valuation spreads were wide. And at the end of year one of a recovery, valuation spreads are back down to their bottom quartile. We are persistently in our top quartile. And this is in sharp contrast to credit spreads being in their bottom fifth percentile of history. To me, regardless of what sentiment indicators say that have short-term correlations but not long-term correlations, this means that I think that there's many more skeptics in the market than people expect, which is why you're getting very quick sell-offs but very quick rebounds.
So it seems that you use the term layering. It almost seems that you've got a conditional approach to probabilities, that it's taking it one step further where it's not just, okay, well, the Fed's pushing up the short end of the curve. Let's see what happens to the long end. It's let's see what happens to the long end when the Fed is tightening, conditional on some other variable that's an important part of the equation. Is that the right way to think about it?
That's exactly right.
That's very interesting to take it that next layer. As you talked about valuation spreads in equities, and then you mentioned credit, and then as you think about the approach to using data and using history, you're noting that history is never the same, but there's some rhythm to these events. But of course, things change over time. The regulatory environment changes. The Fed's sort of mandate to do more and more seems like that's very obvious to us. It bought corporate bonds for the first time last year. How do you think about these data relationships in light of the value of the information content, but also that the set of facts and circumstances does evolve over time so that the relationships themselves may not be static?
You can always roll correlations to see changes. And one of the things, let's talk about changing correlations within the financial sector in terms of outperformance. Whatever worked in terms of your fundamental drivers for financials to outperform before the financial crisis didn't work at all after. Regardless of what happened with earnings, with ROE, even with the global PMI, the stocks tended to underperform when multiples compressed. So it was part of this very different scenario for financial stocks, given that the correlations did change. So you always have to keep an eye on those changing correlations. But I think that as it relates to specifically the Fed, there's certainly been a big narrative around what the Federal Reserve and obviously fiscal stimulus have done this cycle, leaving sort of exogenous factors. And that this is really all driven by the Fed. I hear sort of that internally sometimes. And to me, that doesn't fit with the way that I look at the data. So even when I look at the Fed balance sheet, when I look at the Fed expanding their balance sheet, I have lower odds of an advancing market and lower average returns than in history. And when the Fed is actually shrinking their balance sheet, again, we don't have a lot to go on because the balance sheet has really only flexed over the last 10 years. But when it has shrunk its balance sheet, that's usually when you actually have higher odds of a market advance and higher average returns. So if you look even in the financial crisis, we had very, very accommodative monetary policy, but we still had very poor growth. And it was the slowest economic recovery on record, essentially taking 3 years to get back to prior peaks, and whether it be wages or earnings. And I don't even think we're there yet on industrial production, even after sort of the post-pandemic surge. And when you think of the Fed doing its job from that perspective, it gave all the accommodation that it could, and we still had poor growth. And in some ways, the 70s were the exact flip side, where they were very, very restrictive, and we still had an inflation problem. So to me, the data shows all of those different ways to look at the data. Early in a cycle, the Fed is actually more reactive to the cycle than creating the cycle. So that to me tells me I need to keep my eye on the data, because the data is going to create the Fed reaction. So the data that I look at that's so different, partly they were helping to create, which is the low credit spreads environment, which is a defining point this cycle. I think we're at the lowest spreads that we've ever had, I think, on most of the measures that I look at. And what I think is really interesting is that wages and salaries, even ex transfer payments, are now at all-time highs. So even though we have not employed as many workers as we did employ before, I think we're down about 5 million, the baton has been handed from government stimulus to the corporations, who are now paying more in wages for every person they hire back, so much so that we've regained all we've lost in 11 months instead of 3 years in the financial crisis. So I think that that's going to be what the Fed needs to react to. So I keep my eye on the data.
Well, we'll have a lot to talk about just in terms of the here and now and some of the relationships you observe and where they lead you in terms of sector allocation recommendations, factor recommendations. But let's spend a little bit of time talking about the pandemic, because it's such a terrible event for the world and for the country, for families. The markets saw a gigantic amount of volatility, by some measures even more so, at least over a very short time frame, than the GFC itself. I'm curious if you can bring to light just your process through the pandemic. And specifically, is there an HPA, a housing price appreciation equivalent, from 2008 and 9 that became a metric that you started focusing on during the pandemic, which was not a thing for you a couple of months beforehand, just given your go anywhere process?
Yeah, in some ways we talked about the three, and I think that there were really three key data points that put it together for me. And one was definitely valuation spreads, because you could sort of look back and look at recessions and recessionary declines in the stock market. And interestingly enough, if you average out the last, I think it's seven recessions that I have since 1962, you'll see the peak to trough stocks decline about 35%. We were exactly average. So it was an average recession, despite the fact that it was obviously not an average situation. Not that any recession actually is, but you could sort of apply those recessionary dynamics to it. But what became very clear in looking at recessions historically is that A, stocks discount a recession in advance, which is not to say that they react all the way before a recession, but they tend to bottom during recessions, halfway through, usually on average, but can bottom as early as a quarter of the way through, which was an intensive study I did on 1957, if there is fiscal stimulus. That is typically the point at which, again, that monotonic relationship between fiscal stimulus and the number of months it takes for the stocks to discount a recession in advance. And I remember putting out a report to say, can stocks discount a recession in 1 month? The answer is yes, if you just look at the framework, given the critical drivers and given the valuation spreads. So I think typical recessions, an understanding of how that operates and how a market discounts a recession during them, valuation spreads is, again, a second and I think incredibly underutilized tool, because it really has a much more powerful mathematical certainty around investor fear and the outcomes associated with it for not only the stock market, but on volatility, on value, and on other sort of outsized factors. And I think that shows you just how much risk is discounted. And that's much more helpful than, let's talk about PE, right? So if you remember PE in terms of 2009, I think we got as low as 10 times. Well, that was right before the bottom fell out. So then at the point at which was the bottom, which ended up being, I think, early March 2009, the market was already up to 15 times. Relative to that, it was actually, 50% appreciation. So the market wasn't cheap anymore, but that's not when it went up. So you get this flip in relationships that investors think about valuation, mostly because the E is so wrong during a recession. And you can even see that over time. If you quartile out PE going back to 1962, you'll see that every single quartile, both top to bottom, carries the same odds of a stock market advance, 75. So really, valuation spreads are much more helpful in terms of thinking about what the stock market is actually discounting. And then I think the third thing about the pandemic that's very different is understanding how this cycle is a very different setup than the last cycle, which investors tend to have a little bit of an anchoring bias around what just occurred, or at least a recency bias. And the data setup is so clearly different from a baton handoff from federal stimulus, which we have every cycle, although never to this degree, has been handed to wages and salaries. And that was very clear in the data early on. And it continues to be the case where the labor market is not tight, but it got tighter quicker than any other recession, which told you that wages were more likely to sustainably increase. So I think it's that like trifecta to me that I think informs me about both the pandemic going in and then the recovery coming out.
Tell us a little bit more about how you characterize or quantify valuation spreads, just both maybe across different sectors or factors, how you differentiate it from a basic PE ratio. How do you think about that?
Yeah, so this is just a free float. So it's not sector biased at all. You can take it as the top quartile minus the bottom quartile. So the names change. So in the crises we saw in terms of the 70s, it was actually the Nifty 50 that were the risky stocks, right? So it's not always the spread between consumer staples and technology, if you will, although technology was quite defensive this time. So consumer staples and say financials. So it's not just a sector spread. You see it at the idiosyncratic level. You see it at the stock level. And again, I think it's just fairly simple distribution of math. You can do it on multiple indices. I have it for the S&P 5, the Russell 1000, I have for the mid-cap index, and you can certainly see the correlations even across the globe, although it was most persistent and still is most persistent in the U.S. market, interestingly enough. But that, again, is just one way to measure fear, because that spread is essentially investors selling things they think are risky and buying things they think are safe. And that is exactly the point at which the market is its discounting mechanism, where it's not necessarily that who's going to be the next buyer, it's that there's no more sellers.
And so in a significant market drawdown where the VIX is 40 and rising, what you're going to see is that valuation spread metric, perhaps from the top quartile to the bottom quartile, is going to flatten out. Is that how you look at it?
It can. I mean, usually what you have to do is sort of buy peaks. So you buy top quartile valuation spreads, thinking that over the next time horizon, unknown, but 6 to 9 months, that spread is going to compress, because usually at the top quartile levels, it's not sustainable, that level of fear. Now, you never know if it's going to continue to rise or what it will continue to rise to or how different it is. It's not the same every cycle. And I think that that's why, to your point earlier on layering odds, it wasn't just the valuation spreads. It was the government stimulus that was coincident with the recession for the first time in history, really since, I should say, 1957, because it was coincident in 1957 too. It was very, very close. So really for the first time since 1957, it was those two events together, however very small data points, however small sample size, that were really meaningful to understand what the market dynamic could be.
Well, let's talk about the here and now. We've got a little bit of a hiccup in markets, but not much, still near an all-time high. Some of the sectors underneath the surface aren't doing as well. One point I wanted to just follow up on with you is around the fiscal side. So an incredible, as you note, an incredible amount of fiscal stimulus provided, try to put money in people's pockets, innovations like the PPP Act to try to keep folks in their jobs. But eventually some of that rolls off. I just saw Biden was suggesting that they'll let some of the enhanced benefits roll off in September. How does that work its way into your process, that we've had this impulse, but eventually it fades away and it becomes in some ways a little bit of a tightening? Is that something on your radar screen? How do you handicap the going away of something that's been propelling the market higher?
Yeah, in some ways, that's, history can be a guide here too. And we talked a little bit about the baton handoff, but there is always fiscal stimulus. Again, never to this degree, but there is always fiscal stimulus. And there is always a withdrawal of that stimulus in every single cycle. And that cycle doesn't lead to a GDP contraction. It really doesn't lead to a hiccup in growth. What you'll see this cycle is that we successfully handed that baton from government stimulus to wage growth and are likely to continue to hand that baton to loan growth. So those are usually your, let's call them virtuous cycles, that end up meaning that the roll-off of whatever you're estimating isn't going back to all else equal. If you held everything constant, it would be a drag. But the point is that everything is moving. And the two things that are moving, loans and wages in our case, are going to be moving faster than the withdrawal of that stimulus. So you'll likely see either no effect or no net effect of sort of any contraction. And that goes back to this is just wages and salaries data. So not including transfer payments. It is literally just the amount of people on company payrolls times the wages they pay them. And we're already above pre-pandemic highs. Again, I think it's the quickest recovery that we caught up to where we were before a recession in 11 months. So I think that as much as if we highlight that drag, that might be a concern, I think that there are the other things moving that are more likely than not to offset it, which is what we've seen in history.
Well, as you mentioned wages, it got me thinking about inflation and interest rates. And I know you've done some work on correlations to interest rates among different factors and sectors. You've also done a lot of thinking on diversification, this ever elusive exercise of putting a portfolio together in which things don't move all the time in the same direction. And you've specifically pointed to energy as a sector that you see as having some upside and also providing a pretty good diversification benefit, interacting with inflation, perhaps in a more favorable way than other sectors. Tell us more about your research on energy.
Yeah, I find energy one of the most unique sectors that I'm analyzing now and unique setups in history. So I always like to say that there's two times in an energy investor's life where you really want to perk your ears up and consider investing. And one is when the stocks are cheap across the board. And if you think back to 2014, 2015, 2016, where we did have a global earnings recession, but obviously not an economic one, many pointed to energy being cheap at the time. But it really was only cheap on price to book or price to sales or other asset measures. It was never cheap on price to earnings or free cash flow because they had to spend so much money to get the oil out of the ground. So CapEx relative to their sales base was in the top quartile of its history. And that alone handicaps your odds, regardless of fundamentals when you look at the data historically. So fast forward to the pandemic, and I do a quarterly sector update for clients that is a reflection of my internal research. Most of my charts that I do internally end up in the quarterly sector update that you can find on fidelity.com QSU. And what's interesting is that the second point at which an energy investor should really consider investing is demand declines. And it's not necessarily because the fundamentals of the stocks get better, but it's because usually the stocks look through it on multiple appreciation. So what you have is multiple expansion into the trough, even if earnings are much worse than expected, given that there is a recovery in the future. And that's exactly what happened during the pandemic. But what's been interesting in the way that energy evolved after that was because earnings estimates were so low relative to history. Now, even in year one of the recovery, what you're seeing is energy is cheap again, where usually it is not at this point in the cycle. Usually you're off sort of those low valuation bottom quartile measures. But because it was so underestimated in terms of earnings were underestimated by about 30 percentage points a month. Energy is continually in the cheapest sectors that I look at. And now we're at the point where CapEx to sales is in the exact opposite position as we were in 2014, 15, 16, where it's at all-time lows. So free cash flow yield on energy service companies is the highest it's been since the 70s. So as much as we think of the headwinds of energy companies, when you see valuation levels like that with consistent free cash flow generation, you have to wonder what's already discounted. And this is really the first time in, I think, 40 years that at the bottom of a cycle, meaning demand is declining, energy companies are generating free cash flow. That hasn't happened in 40 years. And the last time it happened that I remember was in 2003 in metals and mining. It was Freeport-McMoRan. I think it was 2001, 2 or 3. I can't remember which year. But I think that that's just how fundamentals have changed in the energy sector, and it's still cheap. So I think that despite the fact that the headwinds are obvious and clear, I think that the risk reward is really interesting here.
It's often said that energy is a sector that provides some inflation protection. Tell us about your data-driven approach to assessing that.
It does historically, but it is different this time, Dean. So it's really interesting. So when you look at the correlations over the last year, really the correlations to inflation, interest rates, and CapEx, because really they're all one variable, are really high for cyclicals versus defensives and for financials and industrials, but they're close to zero for energy. And I think part of that is because as much as energy was a classic inflation play, it has changed this cycle. It was in some ways not the cause of a recession, but the recovery from a recession. And two, it's this massive change in CapEx that's really the idiosyncratic driver behind energy stocks, not inflation itself. So I don't think you need to say, I am betting on inflation, therefore I'm owning energy stocks. I think energy's got a lot more irons in the fire or legs on the stool than many energy investors might expect.
Yeah, and even irrespective of its relationship to inflation, its relationship to other sectors is a little less concentrated in terms of correlations than, let's say, some of the other ones. Energy is a much, much smaller part of the overall S&P in terms of market cap. And so we all recognize that there is a certain amount of benchmarking, even amongst active managers. So taking a large overweight position in energy is difficult just given its size in the benchmark. Are there sectors or factor styles that are related to energy that have similar dynamics to the favorable ones that you've highlighted?
Yes. So I'll put it in sort of two camps. One is, I think if you step back from the market, I think anything economically sensitive, or I'll call it cyclical, is going to lead relative to any defensive. And the defensives that I call have been pretty true to their correlation both this time and historically, and that's consumer staples, utilities, healthcare, to a lesser extent, real estate this time, and then the old telecommunication services, which is now not comm services, but those are the five more defensive buckets. And I think that the risk reward likely stays negative, not because they're all still expensive, although some of them are, but because they are going to have a hard time keeping up in what I think will still be a very strong earnings recovery. So that's the tilt toward, I'll call it cyclicality, which is a big word for anything economically sensitive. I do think that energy is at the top of that list, but it would be followed by industrials, and I think machinery is an interesting highlight here. It would be followed by consumer discretionary. Again, I think equal weighted is a little bit more interesting here. To a lesser extent, financials as well. I think that the risk rewards in those sectors are really interesting and compelling, which is not to say that technology is a problem area. And I do think that the risk reward in technology overall mainly is positive because we're still only at median valuation levels, but we're at all-time high in terms of operating margins, which means they're not really getting credit for that. So I think that there is still some room for valuation expansion, specifically in some areas like semiconductors, which are still cheap on price to book. But I think that unlike, let's call it the year or two ending 2019, where it was technology or bust, and that was the only sector that led the market, I think that this is more of a broadening trend. And it's iterative, obviously. You just highlighted the volatility we've seen. It's growth and then value and then growth and then value. But I think at the end, we're going to look back through a lot of this volatility and say technology did outperform, but the outsized alpha was still in the more economically sensitive sectors. And I'd put value as a factor in that same bucket.
As you talk about growth versus value, I'm just thinking about the S&P at large. And one of the ways I've characterized some of the volatility or sometimes the lack of it in the S&P is that there is a almost internal self-hedging mechanism that is just about a churn. A lot of it's related to interest rates, it seems. You're, as a sector or a factor style, either on one side or the other of the interest rate ledger. And tech stocks would seem to be, at least over the last year or so, it might be a post-pandemic thing where it's intensified, but certainly rising rates have been associated with falling shares of tech stocks. And just given their market caps, that appears to be a vulnerability. I'd love for you to talk about just how rates and correlations to rates make its way into how you put the mosaic together.
That's really interesting in terms of the churn, because I think you're exactly on. That's a great explanation. You know, what you find is people who are asset allocators are at what volatility, but people in asset management or people in equity research are pulling their hair out with this value growth whipsaw over the last 2 months. An interesting one. And they're to some extent correlated to inflation. And I think that this is, are higher interest rates a bad thing or a good thing? And you could say the same thing for inflation. Let's take one and then the other. They're somewhat related, but they're not always related. So the interesting thing about interest rates going higher is you would think that that is somewhat of a deterrent to growth. But what you find is the exact opposite historically, meaning that interest rates are more often than not a function of growth rather than a deterrent to it. So as much as higher interest rates affect growth stocks, occasionally, maybe, sometimes, they don't affect the overall economic outlook. And I think to sort of squint on growth stocks, people focus generally on absolute valuation. And I think that that's much less predictive than relative valuation. I don't find growth stocks, and by growth stocks, I just mean the top quartile of expected growth relative to the S&P on an earnings yield or on a book yield. I don't find those to be outsized expensive relative to history. So when I look at relative valuation, not only is it not expensive, but it has very little correlation to interest rates, which I know is not a popular opinion because I understand that the DCF is supposed to work that way. But I don't find when I look at the data that it is very clear at all. So it's clear to me that interest rates don't necessarily deter growth. And it's not clear at all that they're a problem for growth stocks specifically. Maybe if you isolate valuation, but then again, if you have a higher growth environment, maybe you outgrow the valuation headwind that you're sort of measuring. So I think that there's a risk in that situation. And inflation, I do think that it's different this time, and you could see that in the data starting in 2005. What you saw before 2005 was when inflation was accelerating, you saw multiple depreciation in the S&P overall. So it was clearly an event that the market didn't like, was compressing multiples, thinking that earnings were likely to decline. Since 2005, the correlation has not only gone to zero, but has flip-flopped, meaning anytime inflation was accelerating, what you saw was multiple appreciation in the market, where that was more often than not a good thing. And I think that part of the history puzzle that people are missing is that last cycle was a key risk of deflation, which we didn't see in the 60s, right? We really have not faced deflation risk since the 30s, essentially. Not that that's a comparative example. But so when you think about the evolution of inflation into the late 60s and the 70s, I think what is very, very different this time, many things are different, but one is that we're pricing out the risk of deflation, which was just as corrosive to equity markets as inflation. So from that perspective, it's not clear to me that inflation, to the extent that it's correlated or not with interest rates, is a real headwind to the equity market overall.
So how do we put all this together from a big picture asset allocation framework? We have inflation that is above target. The Fed wants it to be above target, but by some measures, it's potentially slightly uncomfortably above target. You have a Fed that's going to be planning on tapering. You've got a lot of fiscal support. You have incredibly strong earnings. You have, by most people's accounts, pretty high price earnings ratios. How do you put it all together just in terms of the sectors to focus on? Of course, you've mentioned energy, but what are some other areas to tilt towards, both from a sector allocation and factor style standpoint?
Yeah, I think value and financials are particularly interesting too. And I think in some ways, if you put together the playbook, I think what's different this cycle is that it's much more sustainable than last cycle in terms of the risk to wages and in terms of the risk to economic growth. So that virtuous cycle has happened quicker, has happened earlier, and is likely more sustainable. And more importantly, earnings are likely still too low. One of the other differences of this cycle was where upside surprises tend to average around 2 to 5%. We were averaging between 15 to 20. And once you get to those top quartile surprises, what you see very clearly is that they're very sticky. And they're sticky for like 2.5 years sticky, not sticky for a couple months. So what that means is that analysts are reluctant to take out your numbers up still and consistently, which means that earnings are likely too low, which means that any concerns about the multiple are likely your multiple is artificially inflated based on those earnings. So I think you put those two things together and you add in the added complexity this cycle, which is that inflation expectations, which are really more important than inflation itself, are different and higher cycle to cycle because of that sustainable growth, because of that sustainable wage growth. And you get something interesting for value stocks and financials in particular, because financials have been correlated cycle to cycle. They're multiples based on interest rates, specifically inflation expectations and interest rates. And what you might see is that us looking back in 1, 3, or even 5 years and saying, you know, financials fundamentals were pretty mediocre. I mean, returns were still only about average and, you know, earnings growth was, let's call it 10 to 12, but nothing to write home about. But you actually get all of the advance and the outperformance in the market through multiple appreciation. And that's what investors call a pain trade. It's because they're not going up for any reason that is otherwise, and I'll call it a little bit macro, which is inflation and expectations, inflation expectations, and how different it is cycle to cycle. The fundamentals might not be changing, but your relative valuation does. And that's what gives you the tailwind. That's why I think value is sort of unique as a diversifier, and within that, financials as well.
If we're to look at the markets as pretty efficient and acknowledge that there's another side to each view, when you think about your bullishness on financials, what would be potentially the other side of that for an investor that wasn't as keen? Would it be something on the regulatory uncertainty front? Would it be the potential encroachment from fintech? What's the other side, if there is one, for you in the financials?
Yeah, I think the always other side on financials is a recession. So it's the durability of an economic recovery. Regardless of the fact that we've financials changed in the financial crisis through regulation and through a lack of earnings and a lack of returns, what you'll see is still a very, very consistent correlation to global GDP or US GDP and to a lesser extent global GDP. So really the underpinning of the economic recovery is the biggest risk, I think, from a financials perspective. And to me, it's interesting, we're talking about energy. When I go back and look at energy historically, what I see is in a couple years, we're going to get to a spare capacity issue that's low enough to create a much, much higher energy price to the extent that demand is continued. So energy is a unique historical data series in the sense that it is the most correlated to recessions over time, right? It is the shock that leads to the tax on consumers that leads to not always the crisis, but to the decline that is potentially correlated to the crisis. So I think that that's something to keep our eye on in terms of the lack of flow in the energy markets to meet the demand. So when it comes to financials, I think energy is actually a key contributor and something to watch because it relates to the durability of the economic cycle.
Interesting. Well, if we can, I'd love to round out our call, and I want to thank you for taking the time to be a guest, but I'd also love to solicit some of your broad perspectives on being a woman of prominence on the buy side in the financial industry. It's a topic that I ask all my female guests, and I'd love to get your insights as well, just in terms of some of the efforts that have been made over time to sponsor and advance the cause for females in the financial industry, and specifically through the pandemic. Has that initiative or set of initiatives to try to empower women further in our field, has it been hurt by the pandemic, or how have firms worked through this? Just your broad perspective on this would be great.
I'll have to think about the pandemic one. Certainly, it's a numbers issue, and everybody knows the numbers. I think we're in the 20% range within asset management of any category of women being represented. And I think it's been that way for quite some time. And I don't think that there's any debate over whether or not we want more sort of diversity. Diversity of thought is very clearly correlated to better outcomes. The worst thing you can do in asset management is have an echo chamber. And the easiest way to get that is to diversify across backgrounds and across genders and across any way you can to have different perspectives brought to the table. I always say debate leads to better investment conclusions. So this is an important thing for our industry to tackle. It's problematic in the sense that I think the narrative for our business has been, I'd call it one-sided, and I think it's time for women and for everybody to take it back, if you will. And I think that it can be a tough business, and I've heard it called the chronic emotional deficit, because losing hurts twice as much as winning feels good, and that you often win by just the hair of a margin in terms of being a good stock picker. So you run this chronic emotional deficit. And these are things that we use in common vernacular. And they are certainly true, but I don't think that we give enough narrative to just how interesting and rewarding our business is. And I think that that's the point at which we need to take it quickly to women at lower grades. And Fidelity is actually doing that in a Boundless program, which is about finance and targeted at high school females. And it's a way to get them interested and show them what an interesting job this can be. I mean, I'm very passionate about equity research. And I think one of the reasons why I got into it is because there is an endless amount you can do with it. Unlike, let's say, working for the government as a cost analyst, there's only so many things you can do. In equity research, it's endless. The historical data is endless. The ways that you can look at the market are endless. So it's a really uniquely challenging, certainly, and we've talked about the challenges, but it's uniquely rewarding industry and career as well. And I think that we haven't gotten that message out as much as the challenges get out, right? The hardness, the toughness. We hear a lot of that, but we haven't really taken the other side and really talked to people as they're coming up before they consider their career options. So I think that we're doing that more and more, and I think that that will sow the seeds of change. But I think if anybody wants to make that change, that's the way to do it.
Our audience and listeners will appreciate your insights on that. Denise, I want to thank you for being a guest. It was great to hear more about your process, and I want to thank you again for sharing your insights.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Steve.
You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.